Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Welcome and thank you for joining us. Our guests tonight are Paul Jenkins, Greg Erickson, Tim Bradner, and from Fairbanks, from the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, Dermot Cole. Paul, let's start with a story that's sure to be the fodder for, has been, for talk show hosts and for people who write letters to the editor. To the amazement of some assembly members here in Anchorage, it turns out that former Mayor George Sullivan, who died recently, had a $193,000 life insurance policy that was, shall we say, handled just a little bit differently.
I guess. It certainly is confusing. In 1982, former Mayor George Sullivan, who had heart problems, couldn't get insurance when he left office. An assemblyman at that point said, well, what we ought to do is get the Salaries and Emoluments Commission to add him, continue to have him, on the city policy, which they pretty much did. And it was not a controversial thing. They just did it. The premiums were paid. As part of the irrevocable trust of George Sullivan, premiums were paid through the years. I don't know, $30,000, $40,000 worth of premium. Sullivan died last year. His son says, well, all of a sudden...
Who's the mayor?
Who's the mayor? And now the trustee of the irrevocable trust has to go pay the premium payment, which he didn't know, depending on which story you believe. He didn't know that it had to be paid. So he went and paid it, and the city went, huh? So I started looking. In 2002, Aetna had said, listen, he's not working for the city. We're not going to employ him. His medical history, yada, yada, yada. And next thing you know, the premiums are still paid, and they're paid, and they go into a city account. The money goes away, and Wirch's administration looks at it and says, well, former mayor George Wirch says this has got to be paid. Sullivan's administration says it's a contractual thing at this point. It's got to be paid. So we have the mayor of the city who is drawing fire for cutting firefighters and police money, turning around and now is owed his trust that he's the trustee of, is owed $193,000. And the assembly votes for this back in February. This assembly votes for this. And only Harriet Drummond said, what? And
didn't vote. Yeah, I think the one thing we can say for sure is Harriet Drummond was correct when she said a municipality is not an insurance company.
It's not an insurance company. Exactly.
And the other thing is, don't you think this is the kind of thing the public reacts that there are many people who liked George Sullivan and admired him. I'd been in his home several times.
He's a great
man. But still wondered, how does something like this happen unless you got friends in high places?
Well, that's exactly how it happened. This is terrible, terrible public policy. You're going to have guys like me showing up and saying, hey, how about giving me an insurance policy?
Well, then in your case, they'll just say no.
No.
Greg, the biggest story out of Juneau seems to be oil and gas taxes. Some lawmakers say the state has to make changes before May, or we could have build a gas line and not get any tax revenue for it and lose oil revenue. This is, first of all, it's disturbing, and second, it's confusing. Cast some light on it.
Well, back in 2006 and 2007, when the legislature was debating the changes in oil taxes that were proposed first by Governor Murkowski and then by his successor, Governor Palin, there were proposals to allow the oil companies to deduct the costs of their investments in the North Slope oil fields and gas fields. And the plan was adopted that allowed them to roll the two together and consider this production process of oil and gas a single process and the output a single commodity of BTUs. So what, to make this very long and complicated story short, is that if there is a gas line built, it will cost billions and billions of dollars of treatment plants and drilling and infrastructure, and all of that will be allowed to be deducted against the much higher value of oil that is being produced from the North Slope. And you get to what is to some people an anomalous situation where suddenly the gas line that we've been waiting for years and years starts up, and the next day our tax revenue drops. And the reasons for this are...
I think at the least this is counterintuitive.
But it really is... Well, there's a whole lot in this story, Michael, that's counterintuitive, as I'm sure we'll get into. We have Senator Bert Stedman of Sitka, the co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee, being the major proponent of splitting the gas off from the oil. But in 2006, he argued vociferously against splitting it off, saying it would be a nightmare. We have the Republicans, 15 Republicans in the House, who wrote a letter to Parnell, the Governor Parnell, in December, saying that, gee, the oil industry is in trouble. We need to reduce their taxes. We need to give them more incentives. Stedman is saying we want to make sure they don't get this $2 billion windfall, which seems to be the opposite side of that coin. But the Republicans in the House are saying, oh yeah, now we suddenly see the light, that this is something we've got to take up. It's very bizarre, and I have to say it's a little fishy.
Tim Bradner, your assessment after hearing the words bizarre and fishy, take your time.
Well, the word I would use is convoluted and impossible for the public to understand. I mean, how do you, you know, the justification for this thing is that somehow we blended the two hydrocarbon streams together and we're taxing the energy content. And that, you know, I sort of understand that. But how you can get oil revenues adding up to X and gas revenues adding up to Y, and then you add the two together, you'd think you'd get a sum that's higher than either one of them. And instead, somehow in this calculation, you get less. Now, can anybody explain the math of that?
Addition by subtraction, I guess.
Yeah, and the bottom line is something that's impossible to explain. How do you really sell it to your colleagues?
Let's get Dermot Cole in here, and eventually we'll get back to Greg. Dermot.
Well, yeah, Michael, I think it's...
The view from Fairbanks.
It's convoluted, bizarre, and fishy. I think I would add all those three. It does seem that if gas prices remain low, oil prices remain high, we're going to have the situation where, you know, the production of gas actually lowers tax revenue. It's going to be hard to sell that to the public when it's simplified and boiled down to that kind of a statement. One of the things I find a little bit unusual is Les Guerra's take on this now, that he says this is could be a Trojan horse for a way to lower oil taxes. And I wonder what Greg and Tim have to think about that.
Greg.
Well, I think there's a lot of concern. Beth Kertula in the House also, and also I think Hollis French in the Senate have expressed similar sentiments. And one thing we haven't mentioned is that there's this looming May 1 deadline, which puts some more confusion into the mix, because the AGIA pipeline provisions say that any company that makes a commitment to ship gas through the proposed Trans-Canada gas pipeline will have their gas taxes, will have a ceiling on their gas taxes established as of the date, as of May 1. So there's an argument being made that this change to the tax system has to be made before May 1st. I think there's a lot of dispute about that. Lawyers for the legislature and for the Attorney General's office both say that really that's not the case, and there's nothing to prevent the future legislature from splitting the two types of taxation apart, gas from oil. But I just don't see how it computes.
Tim, you want to take another shot at this?
Well, what Greg alluded to, the concern in the House, which Representative Guerra talks about, is that you'll get a tax bill coming over from the Senate. And, of course, in the closing weeks of the session, all sorts of strange things happen. And I think the fear that he and his fellow Democrats have is that the House Republicans will tack onto it provisions that would lower the tax rate, which is what they're working to do in the House. One other thing.
This would provide them with a vehicle to advance their concerns in the name of a greater cause, is what it amounts to, right? We have to do something here.
Yeah, and of course, you could, if you combine the two and then it goes back to the Senate in the closing days of the session, all sorts of things can happen. I might add, too, that the Governor Parnell thinks that this whole thing is overblown. He doesn't agree with Stedman's analysis, and he also thinks that in the end, the producers are going to want to come in and renegotiate a tax package anyway, so all this is academic until that's the real tax that's going to apply.
We haven't had this producers weigh in on this publicly, at least, as far as I'm aware.
Okay, Paul, let's get the final commentator on the commentators. Take it away.
Well, I'm still confused. I have no idea what we're doing here. I guess I'm curious. We have a situation where the linkage between a very high oil price and a very low gas price, it produces this $2 billion can produce a loss. Do they have to be unlinked? Do we have to split them? What if nothing happened?
If nothing happens, the legislature contemplating that $2 billion loss at some future point, it's sort of theoretically a $2 billion loss, could split it in the future. And the state lawyers and the legislative lawyers say that's not a problem.
Tim, isn't a lot of this in the future, isn't it? The answer, it depends. It's very hard to figure out what's going to happen.
Well, it all depends. And I think what this also illustrates is that, a lot of Alaskans think the gas pipeline is going to be the solution to our revenue dilemma, that when the oil runs down, that the gas revenues will replace it. And I think one thing, the productive thing that this discussion will have, I think, is it will tend to educate people, including legislators, that the gas revenues will just not generate the type of revenues that oil does,
okay.
That we really can't depend on the gas pipeline to bail us out.
Thank you very much. Jerome Kern famously wrote, "When your heart's on fire, smoke gets in your eyes." In Fairbanks, Dermot, a lot of people have smoke in their eyes and their hearts are on fire and they're taking it to the assembly. Tell us about it.
Well, wood smoke has become a bigger issue here than in the recent past, largely because of the rise in energy prices. With heating costs being substantially greater than they were, 5 to 10 years ago, a lot of people have switched to wood heat in the Fairbanks area. And Fairbanks has hills around three sides of it, and it's a perfect laboratory for winter air pollution. And the air is often still, so when the wood smoke goes up in the air, it stays there. What's happening now is that Fairbanks is under the gun from the Environmental Protection Agency to provide a plan to clean up its air within the next few years. And many winter days now, we have a yellow or brown haze over the community from wood smoke. And this is causing quite a controversy here about just how to take steps to reduce that level of pollution.
Dermot, does anybody in Fairbanks or in the state know how many people are heating with wood or heating partially with wood?
Actually, Mike, there's all sorts of estimates, but it's several thousand. And the best guess from the borough people is that 40 to 50% of the current air pollution problem is from wood smoke. So it means on days when the air is stagnant, which is, pretty much most of the time in the winter, we're violating the EPA standard for how much the tiny particulates are allowed to be emitted into the air. And there are, and this is not just the EPA rule, there are a lot of health studies saying that, children in particular are at greater risk for developing asthma if they breathe this kind of stuff for too long of a period.
And have the wood advocates coalesced around something they want done or stop the government from doing, or is it just don't tread on us?
Well, sure, it's a lot of that, and what I think is likely to happen is the borough is going to have a regulation program and an education program to get people to burn dry wood. If we just burn dry wood, a lot of this problem would be diminished. But right now, because of the boom in the wood stove sales, lots of people are burning green wood, and you can see it in the air.
And I'll bet that green wood is sold as dry wood. The legislature, almost half of it, goes to Washington for the energy conference. Let's check with a reporter who's covered the legislature for years. Tim, why is this particular conference so important to lawmakers, and what do they tell their constituents they're getting out of it?
Well, Alaska's been a member of this thing for many years, and this is a council of energy-producing states and also happens to have Venezuela and Alberta as members, which is kind of interesting. But Alaska legislators have always gone to it, but never in the numbers that we're...
It's 26th the greatest number I've heard.
And, the argument they have is we're an energy-producing state and we need to be on top of issues. I sort of buy that. But on the other hand, you can sort of see this as spring break, for legislators. On the other hand, I think useful work gets done. I talked to Representative Berta Gardner this morning, who was with a group of Democrats who went to the Corps of Engineers and met with an assistant secretary of the Army about the CD5 permit problem that ConocoPhillips is having that's impeding access to NPRA. So there's a lot of other side meetings go on, which I think are productive. So.
Some people might wonder about it, the breakup's effect on the momentum of the session. Does it make much difference, do you think?
Oh, maybe a little bit, but maybe you could look at it another way. Maybe it's good just to get a break. These guys have been going at it pretty hot and heavy.
Okay. Senator Al Kukesh will apologize to the city of Craig per instructions of the legislature's ethics committee. Paul, what's he apologizing for, and what does the city of Craig get out of this?
Nothing.
They get an apology.
They get an apology within 20 days, preferably. The committee found that he probable cause to believe he probably broke the state ethics law by at a city council meeting, suggesting that he threatened, I suppose, in an oblique way, their capital improvement money if they continued opposing, or if they opposed, a Sea Alaska land bill now pending in the Congress. And he says, well, you know, I didn't mean to. It wasn't, I didn't mean it that way. They took it the wrong way. The committee disagreed with him. He's got 20 days to write the letter. Craig has the satisfaction. He did it once before in Sitka, apparently, and the committee threw that one out because towards the end of it, he added the language that I'm not threatening your capital project.
Tim, does this in any way damage or diminish Representative Senator Kukesh's reputation in the Capitol?
I don't think so. I haven't heard anything about this in the Capitol. Greg, have you heard any discussion?
Yeah, I've heard a little bit, but I think I generally concur that he's part of the majority coalition. It may weaken him in future negotiations for leadership positions and so forth, but generally I think his colleagues figure it's over with now.
Yeah. On the scale of what people have been blamed for in Juneau.
Yeah, on the scale of what people have been blamed for, especially recently. Greg, state budget is your day-to-day beat. You've heard the usual talk of fiscal responsibility for the operating budget, but operating budget deliberations haven't gotten a lot of attention from the media or the public. What can you tell us about the operating budget?
Well, the operating budget is going to emerge almost exactly the way the governor proposed. And that's probably why there hasn't been a lot of controversy or news about it. You hear the usual rhetoric, particularly from Republicans, about the need to look towards the long term and to cut these growing expenditures, particularly in social services. You hear a lot of the usual rhetoric from Democrats about how we need to increase the budget in order to make long-term savings, to work with prevention instead of dealing with the problems after they're in the emergency room. But none of this is happening. It's basically a steady as you go, feel good, do it the same way we did it last year kind of budget. And, you know, maybe that's unfair because around the edges there are a lot of initiatives and so forth and things that are going forward. But it's probably the quietest operating budget year I've ever seen in the 30-some years I've watched it.
Tim, that really is unusual. Tim, I didn't put this on our schedule, but I started thinking, what about the capital budget?
A lot of talk about the capital budget behind the scenes. We'll have a fair surplus this year, and everybody wants a piece of it. Everybody's got ideas about projects. A couple large buildings, the governor is proposing to do a University of Alaska building. There's a crime lab in Anchorage, which is back. No real disagreement with that, but arguments about how to finance it.
And the crime lab has been discussed for years now, right?
That's right. And also the biological sciences building in Fairbanks. Rural senators, Senator Hoffman and Senator Olson urgently need new schools replacements, so that I wouldn't be surprised to see those added to the capital budget. Legislators want to have what they call now community appropriations as a part of the deal, which is their own little capital appropriations that they get to give out. Debate: the governor has agreed to a certain amount of that. You know, they hear the figure of $100 million. Senators have different ideas, multiples of that figure, so it'll be somewhere in between.
Dermot, let's get you back in here. I want to talk about natural gas, but before that, tell us about the very large and expensive buildings that the University of Alaska Fairbanks is hoping to obtain.
Well, as Tim mentioned, the UAF Life Sciences building, it's to provide new labs for biological sciences. Many of its current operations for this, by the way, are inferior to those in the local high schools, and that's really how they need this building in a big way. And the governor's proposed a way of doing it. There's been some opposition, it sounds like, from Anchorage. But people in Fairbanks are pretty strongly in support of that building and you want to make that their priority.
Okay. About natural gas, we understand that natural gas may be trucked in for GVA, one of the local power companies, to a plant in North Pole. What do you expect?
Well, you know, Mike, we've been talking about natural gas for about 40 years, just about, and from the North Slope, and not much has happened. This latest idea is the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority would buy Fairbanks Natural Gas, which is a small local gas utility, and then that entity is going to set up a trucking operation to provide LNG to the local electric utility in North Pole. They're going to truck LNG on the Dalton Highway from the North Slope to North Pole. The GVEA, the Golden Valley Electric Association, may be approving this by late March, and the final details might come together by July.
Okay, and one more subject while we have you here. The University of Alaska brought its finalists for president of the university, the regents did, to Fairbanks to meet and become known a little bit by the community. How did that go?
Well, I think it went pretty well. None of these three people are well known in Fairbanks. John Pugh, of course, is down in Southeast, and Pat Gamble with the railroad in Anchorage. He's known to some degree, but then the third candidate, the president of that university in Georgia. It's sort of a wait and see attitude. I don't know that there's any big clamor for one over the other right now.
Greg, you had a story, and we do have some time for this about the University of Alaska finalists and semifinalists and the question of whether their names should be known to the press and should be public. I think viewers would be surprised by what happened.
Well, we submitted a public records request for the 32 resumes or names of people who had applied. We understood there were 32. And so far that request is still pending, but there was plenty of indication that the university wasn't very enthusiastic about giving that out. Their argument is that we'll get better applications if we can assure people of confidentiality, because people don't want their existing employers to know or be worried that they might be losing or leaving. We're pretty confident that Alaska case law says that it's just flat illegal to keep these resumes secret. When they got it down to six finalists, we did old-fashioned reporting, is just calling around and following up on every rumor, and we're able to identify five of the six finalists. And we published a story about that, which was much to the amazement of some of the university bureaucrats. But I think the process has been flawed by the secrecy involved, and I don't think that's good for the university or for the state.
I want to add this, Paul and Tim, real quickly. Paul, how common is it when you go to the government officials that they just say, we're not going to give you this, and
in this state,
hope that you go away? Yeah.
In this state, yeah. It's more common than not. Under the Palin administration and previous administrations as well, you have difficulty obtaining anything, and they'll do whatever they can to put roadblocks in front. I mean, the compliance with open meetings and open record law in the state is nothing short of abysmal.
There's no sanction if
exactly if
a bureaucrat or a politician decides, or university regents decide it's in their interest or the interest of their institution to keep these secret, and if by some chance they get sued on it. It's a tremendously expensive process for a news organization or an individual to sue. But if they do, and they win, there's nothing happens adverse to the organization.
Tim, this might be just asking you to pile on here, but what's your experience been? Consistent with what they're saying?
Well, I think a lot of it depends on maybe in the fields I report on, it's a bit of more narrow focus. It depends on the relationship you have with the source material. I haven't had a lot of difficulties, but over the years, but there have been some.
Okay, and those are usually over things that are important and significant.
Unfortunately,
Unfortunately. Greg, the Alaska budget report broke a story this week about Attorney General Sullivan's decision to pay a group of public interest lawyers almost $1 million. Please tell us about this.
The issue arose over allegations in a lawsuit filed in 2007 by the Native American Rights Fund and the Alaska Office of the ACLU, alleging violation of the Voters Federal Voting Rights Act in Western Alaska. And the Division of Elections and the state was pretty shocked to hear that they were being that these allegations were being made against them. But when discovery proceeded and there were depositions taken of some of the plaintiffs, it became apparent that there were real problems in Western Alaska for Yupik speakers, particularly elderly Yupik speakers, who had no way of knowing really what these yes-no proposition questions really meant. There was inadequate translation services. The bizarre thing about this, or to use a word we've used before, is that resolving this problem is going to cost absolutely no state money. It's all going to be federal money that are going to pay for the extra translations and the extra translators and so forth. And yet it is taken...
I need to translate right now. The translation I'm going to give is I have to say goodbye because we're out of time. See you next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.